Blog Talk Radio.
Goodbye, Joe. Me gotta go, me oh my oh. Me gotta go, pull the P-Row down the bayou. My Yvonne, the sweetest one, me oh my oh. Son of a gun, we'll have big fun on the bayou. Jumbo line, a crawfish pie, and a filet gumbo. Cause tonight I'm gonna see Mama Shazamio. Pick guitar, fill fruit jar, and be gay, oh. Son of a gun, we'll have big fun on the bayou.
And every moment of every day, your 17 trillion cells are being reborn. They are dying and being reborn, being regenerated again. And are you contributing towards healthy cellular regeneration, or are you contributing towards cellular death? And these are the questions we attempt to answer and more on this show. This is Eating for Meaning. My name is Dr. Millie Lytle, and I want to thank you all for tuning in. We've got a very special show today. Today it seems like the tides are going to turn, and I have a special guest who will be coming on in about 20 minutes, and she'll be interviewing me. Her name is Rosemary Heather, and she is the founder of a new digital media magazine called Q&A. And she'll be joining me in about 20 minutes, and we'll be talking about art and life extension and the new digital age and how we secure entrepreneurial goals when the when business is really changing and a lot more is happening online. And so we're going to have a really interesting conversation here on Eating for Meaning today. She's a friend of mine, and she's somebody who I've been engaging in conversation with for years now on natural life extension and the things that we share in common, such as branding and making a business and creating entrepreneurial ventures. And so we're going to be talking about that. But first, I am going to touch on some aspects of Eating for Meaning. Again, my name is Dr. Millie. I am a naturopathic doctor. I am a certified nutrition specialist, and I have my master's in public health. And I'm the founder of a year-long nutrition program called Eating for Meaning. Eating for Meaning is a nutrition program that teaches you how to change your relationship to food. So instead of being a fad diet, it actually helps us assess our own relationship to food and make changes to by reprogramming attitudes we have about our body's metabolism and about our willpower. And I offer lots of practical tips, but also provide easy ways that you can look at your food from a different way so that you can introduce, one, more nutrition into your diet, two, you can seek out adventure, you can have fun when you're trying to eat healthy and when you're trying to learn new foods to incorporate into your diet, because the more variety you have in your diet, the more nutrition. And if you want to gain all your nutrients from food, if this is even possible, then you actually have to vary your diet further than the 10 most common foods that you're eating on a daily basis and really incorporate a lot more fruits and vegetables and different kinds of fruits and vegetables. So not only more servings of fruits and vegetables, but different fruits and vegetables, different colors of fruits and vegetables maybe that you haven't done before. So that's the principle of adventure. Mindfulness, which is paying attention and becoming aware to the way that food impacts you. Does food give you energy? How do you feel after you eat the food? Are you feeling happy? Are you satisfied? Are you hungry again soon? Are you in a good mood or are you in a bad mood? Food should really give us good energy and make us feel better, make us feel satiated, as opposed to the opposite. You shouldn't have to sit on the couch and unbutton your pants for an hour. And you also shouldn't be hungry an hour later after you've eaten a full meal. And so paying attention to the way food makes us feel, also paying attention to our environment and the way food is manufactured and the way food is processed. This is also an important part of mindfulness and being at one in the universe and participating in a healthy community and in a healthy world. Environmental influences on our food supply is becoming an extremely important consideration when choosing your foods. And we're going to be talking a little bit about this today because we're going to be talking about hormones. And I'm going to talk about obesogens. And obesogens is a new classification of hormones, of chemicals that enter our body through our food supply and then also through our environment that mimic estrogens in the body. And so we're going to be talking about obesogens for a bit today and how this influences your estrogen and your progesterone. And so if you're a woman in menopause or a man in andropause, how it influences your testosterone. And so tune in and take note if this is an area of interest for you. And if you know anybody interested in this area of health and nutrition, then please do follow me along at blogtalkradio.com/eatingformeaning. This is Eating for Meaning. Or go to my website at milliesays.com, and you can find all sorts of information about my Eating for Meaning program. You can contact me there, and you can order the program so that you can get on board starting to change your diet. This is not about fad nutrition. This is really about making long-term changes to your diet so that you are eating the best for you as an individual. The fourth principle of Eating for Meaning is something called epigenetics. And epigenetics is a field of science that says that we are not just a product of the genes we are born with. Just because you have a gene for a certain illness or just because you have a certain healthy gene does not mean that you will absolutely express that gene. So, for instance, if you have a gene for autoimmune conditions or if you have a gene for diabetes or for a certain type of cancer, this gene will not automatically be expressed. It really depends on what your environment is like. And so, back to the environment. There are a certain category of estrogen mimickers, estrogen dominant chemicals that come from our plastics. They come from phthalates in our plastic water bottles, baby bottles, plastic baby bottles, plastic microwavable food. If you microwave your Tupperware, especially if anything gets heated, plastics degrade and these estrogens seep into our food and into our water and into our drink. Soda that's from in a plastic bottle is one of the worst because the soda is acidic and it breaks down the plastics all the time and you become exposed and you're ingesting these plastics. And these plastics are not just plastics that stay dormant in your system. What does your body do with plastic? Well, when plastics break down, they mimic estrogen and they mimic harmful estrogens and they become what we call xenoestrogens. And xenoestrogens are chemical estrogen mimickers that do not get broken down. Our body cannot break them down. Our body can store them. And so the estrogen mimickers get stored in our fat cells. And the more fat cells we have, the more able we are to store more estrogen. And this estrogen is carcinogenic. It puts us at risk for estrogen-related illnesses such as breast cancer, ovarian cancer, prostate cancer. It also makes it very difficult for us to lose weight. Because it's very difficult to break down these estrogens, it is possible. I should not say it's not impossible, but it puts a lot of extra stress and burden on our liver that processes hormones anyway. And if our liver gets bogged down and is not properly detoxifying these estrogen-related substances, then they just end up getting stored or recirculating in our bloodstream, and they end up getting deposited at the sites where we should have estrogens. Now, we can do a few things that helps us reduce these estrogens, but let's just talk a little bit more about the sources of obesogens in our diet. So I mentioned all the plastics that are in the food and containing and holding the food and the drinks that we consume. Also, they're found in the lining of tin cans, BPA, bisphenol A. Bisphenol A also breaks down into a xenoestrogen. Let's talk about those nasty GMOs, genetically modified organisms. Now, if you look up GMO in Wikipedia, or if you look up GMO in the dictionary, what you find is a general description whereby a food has a foreign gene inserted into it. So it could be a gene of a fish, if it's a tomato, or it could be a gene of of a potato if it's a tomato. So it could be any kind of, or it could be a gene that allows rice to produce beta carotene. So it could be potentially even some beneficial uses. Genetic modification just means that they're altering the genes, the genetic makeup of the plant. However, Monsanto is a company that produces the genetically modified organism foods, the food staples in our country. And the way that they genetically modify food is that they make genes that produce pesticides. So they actually insert into the cellular DNA of the plant, of the seed, whether it's soybeans or corn or canola oil or cottonseed, or alfalfa is becoming genetically modified. There's certain zucchinis and papayas grown in Hawaii that are becoming genetically modified. But the biggest, and then the sugar beet, but the biggest cash crops that are genetically modified are the sugar beet, the corn, the soy, the canola, and the cotton. And then alfalfa is being genetically modified and fed to our cattle. And so it's getting into the dairy supply and into the meat supply. And the danger of this is because genetic modification in these terms means that they are inserting a virus into the gene of the organism, of the seed, that allows it to be resistant to pesticides. It allows it to be resistant to Roundup. Roundup is a pesticide that's produced by Monsanto. And so when Monsanto makes these seeds that are resistant to Roundup, not only do they spray the product a lot more with Roundup, but also there's no ability to wash off any pesticides of the plant itself because the plant is actually producing pesticides on its own. And so when we consume these foods, we are just getting a lot of endocrine disruption. And so studies show that genetically modified foods are not safe, that they actually do increase our dangerous estrogens or xenoestrogens. And why is this? Because pesticides are estrogenic. So in some cities around North America, Toronto, for instance, where I lived for about 15, 16 years, they actually banned spraying plants and grass and all the greenery, shrubbery, with pesticides. Even on your own personal lawn, you're not allowed to spray it. And why is this? Because it's cancer-causing. It's harmful for your sexual reproduction. It's harmful for your breasts. It's harmful for your prostate. It's harmful for your ovaries. And especially as women and men get older, first of all, it could potentially disrupt fertility, especially if children are introduced to pesticides. In the Mexican valleys, where they grow a lot of food for the United States, where they grow a lot of fruits and vegetables, the kids who live in the Mexican valley, because it's in a valley, the pesticides are not able to escape. And the kids are having early puberty. The girls are growing breasts very early. The boys are having fewer boys being born, and they're having feminization traits happening. So less testosterone production, less semen production, less fertile. And so this has a potentially detrimental future for our children and for our reproduction abilities. And this is exactly why several countries, at least a dozen countries around the world, have banned importing genetically modified organisms into their country because they do believe it's a health risk and poses a health risk for their children as well as their adults. And as we age, as we start to store more fat, and as our bodies become less resilient to the environment, and as we tend to develop more health problems, having all these circulating estrogens can become even more harmful because our bodies are no longer necessarily regenerating cells in a healthy way anymore. And so if there is this exposure to harmful estrogens, then we're more likely to suffer consequences of this, developing breast cancer, prostate cancer, especially if you have obesity around the middle. Now, if you have obesity around the middle, central obesity, that is a result of eating too many carbohydrates, having too much insulin, and having too much of the stress hormone called cortisol. Now, cortisol gets produced, first should be produced early in the morning when we wake up. And when we wake up in the morning, cortisol is a hormone that allows us to wake up and be alert. Now, when we, throughout the day, cortisol levels reduce, and then our melatonin in the evening increases, and that's our sleep hormone. And all of these hormones work together by not only converting into one another, but also being dependent on the production of one for the production of the other. So we need some levels of cortisol, and we need, in order to be energetic, but we also need the cortisol levels to fall throughout the day so that we can sleep at night. Now, if our stress is high, if we're chronically stressed, menopause is a time of one's life where we do suffer stress. We suffer the stress of our hormones changing. We suffer the stress of our progesterone first declining from around the age of 40 onwards, and progesterone declines over a period of about 10 years. Some women go on bioidentical hormones, or they start improving their phytoestrogens and their phytoprogesterones in their diet, so that they can support their level of hormone balance. Or they might take a birth control pill because they're feeling like they're going through puberty again. So different things happen as women are approaching menopause. And then at menopause, that's when our estrogen drops drastically. Now, if we have all these synthetic harmful estrogens in our body, then we might actually experience the signs and symptoms of menopause a lot more. So more hot flashes, less sleep, more stress, higher levels of cortisol, more weight gain, especially in around the middle. A lot of people, a lot of women find that just at the age of 52, when their period starts, from that point on, they gain a lot of weight. And that is a sign that there's excess estrogen circulating. And it could be harmful estrogen, these plastic xenoestrogens. For men, if men have central obesity, if they have a big fat belly, then this means that they're more likely to have higher levels of estrogen, and that their testosterone also dwindles past the age of 40, and testosterone converts into estrogen in some cases. The more of a big belly that a man has, the more fatty is around the belly, this also means that the more likely the testosterone is being shunted into estrogens, and those estrogens can be harmful. They can be cancer-causing. They can contribute towards low libido, lack of sex drive, but then also such things like prostate cancer or enlarged prostate cancer, frequent urination at night, and a lot of stress, higher cortisol levels. And so we can help to balance out all of our hormones as we age by removing all these sources of chemical estrogens from our household and from our diet. There's other chemicals that we use to clean, such as bleach, and cleaning products that also are called obesogens. Even latex gloves, people who have sensitivities to latex, those can become obesogens. And so by cleaning up our home, cleaning up our environment, stopping using all the fabric softeners and the plastics, and switching over to glass and glass bottles, and cutting the sugars out of our diet, the refined sugars, then we can starting to eat organic, and stopping eating foods that have been sprayed with pesticides, and getting the genetically modified foods out of our diet, then we can eliminate the burden that's coming in from these false estrogens, from these harmful synthetic estrogens. And then we can work to detoxify our system, so we can work on improving the function of our liver by taking bitter foods, such as waking up in the morning and taking hot lemon water, drinking green tea, cups of green tea, which is a phytoestrogen. Now, phytoestrogen is a classification of phytonutrients, plant-based nutrients, that also mimic estrogen. But instead of mimicking harmful estrogens, cancer-causing estrogens like the plastics and all these chemicals do, phytoestrogens actually mimic weak estrogens, the protective estrogens. And so we can increase the sources of phytoestrogens in our diet, especially organic, especially when it comes to soy. Soybeans are the second highest source of phytoestrogen content, and soy is prolific in our food supply because it's one of the genetically modified crops. So it's absolutely imperative to remove all non-organic soy from the diet. No mock meats, no soy burgers, no soy dogs that are not organic. It's absolutely not healthy to be eating that. However, it is healthy to be eating organic soy, because organic soy actually have phytoestrogens that mimic weak estrogens. Now, flax seeds, soybeans are only trumped by flax seeds in terms of their concentrations of phytoestrogens. So flax seeds have the highest, most protective amounts of phytoestrogens, and flax seeds have been shown to be beneficial for everything from reducing hot flashes to increasing lubrication during menopause, while not proliferating breast tissue. So not only do they help us maintain our normal body functions and reduce the signs of menopause, they don't actually cause breast cancer like so many of the hormones do. So soybeans are second, and certain products that are made from soybeans are really close. And so soy nuts and tofu and tempeh and miso and soy yogurt and soy protein powder, but all of these should be organic. And even fermented or sprouted soy, it tends to be more digestible and more healthier for us than just regular soy like edamame or soy nuts, or as I mentioned, mock meat products like tofurkey or tofutti cuties or some of the Eve's patties or whatever brand you're looking at. And when you buy tofu, you really want to buy sprouted tofu that's made with nigiri, which is kind of soy, which is a kind of seaweed. And that is the way that tofu should really be made, and that is the only kind of tofu really to buy. Sesame seeds are a third after soy. And hummus. Hummus is close. Garlic has a lot of phytoestrogens. And then we're talking about sprouts, mung bean sprouts, alfalfa sprouts, broccoli sprouts. Which gets us into the brassica family of vegetables. The brassica family of vegetables are also very high in phytoestrogens, and so you should be eating broccoli and kale and cauliflower and kohlrabi and all of these foods to help detoxify estrogen from your body, these bad estrogens and harmful estrogens. And so I hope that's been helpful for you. And when we come back from after the break, we are going to be joined by our very special guest host. Her name is Rosemary Heather, and I will give her bio when we come back after the break.
She wants to know where the relationship is going. He didn't know it was going anywhere. Having an awareness of our differences can make or break a relationship. As men and women, we have no problem falling in love. The problem is staying in love. Janice Hoffman gives men and women easy-to-use tools to keep the passion alive in their relationship. The former training director for Mars Venus Institute, Janice Hoffman trained over 550 Mars Venus facilitators and counselors and developed curriculum for the Mars Venus workshops. Today, she is the award-winning author of Relationship Rules, 12 Strategies for Creating a Love That Lasts. Don't do more in your relationship. Do what you already do differently. Let Janice Hoffman teach you the skills to keep the passion alive. Get the passion back with Relationship Rules. Visit JaniceHoffman.com today and get your own autographed copy of Relationship Rules.
Are you single and ready for an extraordinary relationship? This is Jill Crosby, owner of SpiritualSingles.com, the largest exclusively conscious dating site online. We provide conscious, spiritually evolved singles an easy, fun, effective venue to meet other like-hearted spiritual singles. Join for free today and meet your soulmate, twin flame, poly partners, and or friends on SpiritualSingles.com. That's SpiritualSingles.com.
Okay, and welcome back. This is Dr. Millie, host of Eating for Meaning, and I'm excited to welcome my friend and very special guest host. Her name is Rosemary Heather, and while I am in New York, the beauty of online radio is that I am in New York and Rosemary Heather is in Toronto. Rosemary Heather writes about art, the moving image, and digital culture for numerous publications, artist monographs, and related projects internationally, including Canadian Art from Toronto, Border Crossings from Winnipeg, Manitoba, Art Papers in Atlanta, Flash Art in Milan, Cactus in Toronto, Von Hundert Berlin, Daddy in Los Angeles, and many, many others from New York, Berlin, Milan, from New York Arts News, among others. And so she has lots of publications going on regularly, and her ongoing project is The Real and How to Find It, which interviews artists about the subject of the real. Those are in caps. Recent interviews include Ken Lum, Carrie Tribe, Hito Stale, Phil Collins, and Candace Bright, a co-author of the collectively written novel Philip, which is Project Art Center in Dublin in 2006 exhibition. She has curated, and her curations also include screen and decor from Justin M. Barnicky Gallery in Toronto, Southern Alberta Art Gallery in Lethbridge, Alberta, Illingsworth Kerr Gallery in Calgary, and the list goes on. From 2003 to 2009, she was the editor of C Magazine, and between 2012 to 2014, she worked as director of publications and communications for Fogo Island Arts, which is this tiny little island off the coast of Newfoundland in Canada, Fogo Island, Newfoundland. And Rosemary Heather is currently editor-in-chief of the new digital imprint Q&A, which can be found at qqqandaaa.com, that's qandaa.com, and online archive of her writing can be found at rosemheather.com. So I'm very happy to welcome my very special guest host, Rosemary Heather. Thanks for so much for joining me today, Rosemary. How are you?
Hi, Minnie. I'm great. Thanks for inviting me on the show.
Thanks so much for being here. And so I was explaining at the top of the show before you came on that we've been friends for a long time, and we've been discussing throughout that time common subjects of interest, even though really we have different business pursuits and we're really not in the same profession. For instance, I was explaining to the audience that this is a show about health and your business is not health, but how do you see yourself, how do you see our conversations that continue?
Well, aside from the fact that health is relevant to everyone, so that's always a topic that is of interest. You know, a point of sort of commonality that I have with you is being entrepreneurial, which I'm working more towards because we're sort of in a new economic climate, and I'm looking for ways to apply my skills in a more entrepreneurial way. And this is something that you do, and I see that as connected to the work you do as a naturopath. I'm just wondering, this is a question I had for you before about how you think entrepreneurialism serves you know, the business that you're developing as a naturopath. I don't know if you have anything to say about that.
How being an entrepreneur can serve my business as a naturopath?
Yeah.
Well, I went to a talk the other night, actually. There's this new, it's a year long. It's been around for a year. It's called Functional Forum, The Evolution of Medicine. And it's a year long, or it's been around for a year, and it's a monthly platform of guest speakers all in the medical field, mostly functional medical doctors. Functional medical doctors is a new word for doctors who are more alternative than integrative, so they're actually using dietary supplements and diet and lifestyle to approach medicine. And so me being a naturopathic doctor, that's of course what we do. We do it from a naturopathic standpoint, but now there's medical doctors who are doing that as well. And this platform engages people how to develop their business, because the way that healthcare is changing, and because of the way that the insurances is changing, and a lot more is becoming uncertain for people, especially here in the United States with the introduction of Obamacare, and you know, people's insurance plans are changing. There's a lot higher deductibles, so people have to pay more upfront in order to get healthcare. And so people really are turning towards more of an entrepreneurial model, I think, of seeking out health. And as far as that relates to me, in this talk that I was at the other night, a lot of us are looking at how we develop a healthcare model that fits what patients are looking for in this digital age. And so not only about providing the type of medicine that we want to provide at an affordable and yet lucrative price, that's very difficult to be affordable and lucrative. Also here in the United States, in New York where I practice, and it's an unlicensed state, so naturopathic medicine is not licensed here. So one, that means that I have no option. I cannot take health insurance whatsoever, so it's always out of pocket. And I'm always seeking how to make resources most available to my patients, but also, you know, at the minimum effort for everybody, because here in New York, everybody's, you know, everybody wants time. And of course, everybody wants money. And so we're trying to balance these things. So definitely, absolutely, more than ever now, I think it's important to be an entrepreneur as well as a healthcare professional. And those absolutely do merge on all of those wavelengths.
So you're breaking new ground, so to speak.
Yeah.
Because the type of practice that you do, but this emphasis on functional medicine, as you call it, aren't these sort of really, ancient practices or the base non-Western practices that are just now becoming more popular in the West? Would you say that?
I would say that humans have always had an access to healthcare, so healthcare that's all around us and within our own, so which is autonomous, whether it comes from a healer or a shaman, or whether it comes from your grandmother, or whether it comes from your own internal wisdom and awareness of what is good for you, which includes experience, mm-hmm. personal experience. So it's definitely, naturopathic medicine definitely focuses on that, focuses on the body's ability to heal itself. And I do believe that if people pay attention, that's really how we make behavior change, not by necessarily listening to others and doing what others tell us so much, as much as being tuned into our own body's wisdom, although we do need guidance for that. So I think people are becoming more interested in that because the medical system is really just the drug system and the sick care system, and people are really becoming very frustrated. And if you can take something that's going to take your headache away, then wouldn't you rather it be natural and healthy as opposed to having side effects? So at the same time, now that's different about the ancient traditions is that things are evidence-based and there's scientific literature and there's research being conducted on natural supplements and on herbs and on food and the benefits of changing one's diet, including vegetables and, you know, reducing dairy and all these things. And so it is really the sign of the times is really to, in some ways, DIY, do it yourself, take charge of your own health care, become more, realize your own choice and options as opposed to just listening to other people, and three, follow really what is becoming obvious in the research that probably natural treatments are more designed towards the health, the diseases that we're suffering from at this time, because chronic illness is all nutritionally related disease. It's not generally stuff that can be cured with a vaccine or with a drug. So all of those things.
And can you maybe say a bit more about what you were talking about evidence basis of naturopathy? Is that what you're talking about?
Evidence-based medicine means that there's sufficient research, strong research. Clinical trials really are the most robust form of research. That means that you take a bunch of sick people, you divide the group in half, you blind them as to whether or not they're receiving a placebo or a drug or a nutrient. And then if it's a really robust trial, then you do a washout period, so where you're not giving anybody anything, and then you cross the group over. So you give the same group that received the opposite group that receives the placebo, you give them the treatment the next time, and vice versa, you give the treatment group the placebo the next time, and you see what worked. You see if it worked or not. And so as evidence-based medicine has become the new catchphrase, and this is since really the 90s and maybe even before, that we're really turning to the research to determine whether or not something works, natural medicine is also going through the same process, and naturopathic medicine has developed as, I think, if it used to just be an art form of folklore medicine and using traditional methods from all around the world, like German nature cure and mixed with Chinese medicine, mixed with Ayurvedic medicine, mixed with Native American herbs, herbalism, mixed with some a new age, you know, energy work type of, and chiropractic, all these, naturopathic medicine really came out of all of these, emerging of all of these, but has since 70s and definitely more since the 90s worked on also incorporating the scientific value, the evidence basis. So those are the things that, those are, I practice in all of those ways.
So it's becoming more, this is a function of naturopathic medicine becoming more mainstream, you would say?
I would say it's a function of it trying to compete with medicine and trying to validate itself as a profession. And I'm not, you know, I like the research component of it, but just because something's proven in research doesn't mean that it's the best thing. And also just because something's not proven does not mean that it doesn't work. You know, research does not dictate whether something is effective or not. It just shows us whether it is or not.
Can you comment about, sorry, go on.
No, go ahead.
Just about the scale, like the scale of the research, in terms of like what's the threshold for determining whether it's a study is considered legitimate, how many people would have to participate in a trial, for instance.
Yeah, so that really varies. I mean, it really varies on, there's so many variables in that. One, there's variables in terms of how common the illness is. So rare disease research definitely has fewer numbers of people, and a research trial that gets published could have as few as 10 to 12 participants. And usually one trial would not be enough, but then trials can have as many as thousands of participants, and they can happen at multiple centers all at once, or they can, and those would be clinical trials, or they can be more public health interviews. So when the government sends around the census, for instance, and asks us about our consumption of fruit and vegetables, or the National Health survey sends around and tells us about, you know, whether we're smoking and how many people in the household are, you know, eating fruits and vegetables or and which kinds and all these things. So those are more public health interventions, and so those would require more people in order to get a good idea. Usually a clinical trial wouldn't require as many people, and so any valid would be anything between, in, you know, double digits all the way up to the thousands, but usually it's more in the hundreds. It takes so much money to run a clinical trial. So the problem is with bias is that it's usually only wealthy research, established research organizations or college or universities that are actually rich enough or wealthy enough to conduct what would be considered a good quality trial. So, you know, and that actually it gives the illusion of certainty, but it actually creates a lot of bias, because when it's such a big study and there's so much, and then it's definitely being funded, and then you have to look at, see who the stakeholders are and who's actually benefiting from the answers. So
right.
From the publish of the results, and that's, you know, that's where the pharmaceutical company comes in, and then also other stakeholders, political stakeholders, or nutritional stakeholders, if it's done nutritionally. So, you know, your question, it's a very complex question. I mean, all sorts of things get published, and then it could come down to just the body of overall research, and there's definite questions. There's definitely disagreement or discussion about what is included in body of research, too. Do you include historical value of, like, an herb? You go back 3,000 years and look at all the time that people have been using green tea, or do you only start in the 90s when they've actually been starting to use clinical trials, you know? So there is a type of research called meta-analysis where they would pool all the clinical trials together and look to see, even if the trials are small, they'd pool them all together and see if the plant worked or if the food worked. And so those things are also considered to be strong research when there's multiple trials that have been pulled together and kind of summarized.
And how did they do that meta-analysis? Is that an algorithm, or is it just a human analysis of the findings based on...
So if you go into, there's a lot of medical research databases. So, mm-hmm. for instance, NCBI publishes a platform called PubMed, P-U-B-M-E-D, PubMed. And PubMed mm-hmm. is where all medical research, most medical research, and even environmental and toxicology studies and even sociology studies can get published on PubMed. And so that would be a place to find abstracts for things that are published. But you can go further into, there's other research databases, Embase, and the big kind of grandfather of all, or not even grandfather, but more like father time of all research is called the Cochrane Database, the Cochrane Library Database. And so these are online storage facilities, storage banks that organize and systematize published research. And so generally, if somebody's doing a meta-analysis or really looking through research, they'll look at several of these online databases, and they could be, you know, they could be looking for German ones, or they could be looking for Chinese ones, or they could be looking for just English ones. It really depends on the capabilities of the researchers, and it really depends on the extent of the research question and the topic as well. So you know, it's never all inclusive. Research is never all inclusive. It always has inclusion criteria and exclusion criteria, and those things are really important. And those things are also never really published in newspapers or never really understood or known by people who end up trying to make use of the research. So there's much bias in research. It's all human. It's human.
Okay, that's a good. That makes sense. So, but this is something that I know you've been participated in studies about uses of naturopathic medicine in combination with Western medicine. Is that's right, isn't it?
Yep. So I was involved in a study 3 years ago where I interviewed naturopathic doctors, midwives, chiropractors and native Canadian healers on their role in their community, how they performed their healthcare duties, and whether or not they were integrated with Western medicine or with the medical centers in their area. And then I also included in that study. That study was a qualitative study, so it was all just based on interviews, which is really more of a social science study, a sociological study, or it was a public health study. So we weren't looking for quantitative results, really, except for maybe just looking at, like, there was no empirical data other than just looking at numbers of people who felt that they were integrating versus not integrating. And then we also studied two centers in Ontario, so it was all done in rural Ontario, which is like around Toronto, and we looked at two centers, one hospital and one community health center, who actually had merged Western medicine and alternative medicine, and what models they were using to do that, and how they were going about funding it, and how it was being perceived by the medical doctors and by the shaman or the native healers there. So, I mean, that was fascinating, so fun, so interesting. But we were just looking to answer the question, are people integrating or are they not integrating, and what are the opportunities for integration? And if they are integrating, how are they doing so, and what models are they following? And then, look, here's two examples that they are integrating. So we were just kind of establishing a base of literature, a base of knowledge that this integration is happening.
And why do you think it's happening now, or why do you think there was it's taken until now for it to be more receptive attitude towards sort of non-mainstream medical practices by medical practitioners? Because I think that's who you were, that's the focus of your study, correct?
Yeah. Well, I think that people are, I think that, you know, when there's so much alienation and so much isolation, and that there's always a reaction So people can only get pushed so far, and then there actually is some kind of mini revolution that happens, and that mini revolution within individuals can also play out culturally. And there's waves, you know, there's waves that happen. So, and there's a timing to those waves. So there's so many issues involved in that. So one thing is that, you know, we're living in the new world here in Canada and the United States. And so, but medicine, Johns Hopkins model of medicine, pharmaceuticals and surgery has only been around since like just after the turn of the century. And that was very much a business decision. And so history has caught up with that, I think, that there's an awareness that that was just a business decision. It was subsidized by Carnegie. It was subsidized by Rockefeller. These two brothers, the Flexner brothers, were hired to produce a report that showed that pharmaceuticals and technology-based medicine is the way of the future. And then they indoctrinated the government to fund, the American Medical Association, which only supported health practitioners who had gone to a specific set of medical schools. And so there was a systematic wave that formed around medicine being created as what it was. And at that time, anybody who did not fall into what those guidelines were just called quacks. They were arrested. They were called quacks. They were on the outside. They were practicing something other than what medicine is, because we're defining what medicine is, and everything that's outside of medicine is not. And so even though those people had been, you know, there was 20 homeopathies or 200, I don't remember how many homeopathy schools in the United States in 1910. By 1920, there was like two. And so this is a result of, you know, these kind of tactics, strategizing tactics to make one system dominate and the other one subordinate. And so, or disappear, really. But just because it happened here, then there was like the resurgence of the health movement in the 70s, Adele Davis and Andrew Weil and all these kind of nutritionists. And people, I think, were sick maybe of medicine by the 70s in terms of, there were, you know, the hippie movement. And there's just been so many different political and cultural phenomenons that happened to assist people in wanting to make the change, not only. There's always people who are using traditional medicine, you know, and the rest of the world did not necessarily adopt the Johns Hopkins model at the same time as Canada and the United States. So while Canada and the United States are only focusing on medicine, so-called medicine, Germany is still using herbs and organic food in order to treat 75% of their population. Or China is still using traditional Chinese medicine, even though through their waves of communism. Or, you know, Japan is still using kind of old form methods of convalescence for their patients and baths and all these kinds of things. And so it's not, as the global village has gotten, as the globe has become a village, I should say, and shrunk down, people are looking more towards what other people are doing. There's a lot more travel. People are immigrating. They're bringing their cultures with them. And so, Rosemary, all of these things have all happened throughout the century that have made people more aware of their neighbor and more aware of their own choice. Not to mention there's the whole Native, you know, Native Canadian shame where the government that they basically genocided Native Canadians, and they had them stop talking their language, and they brought them into schools, and they adopted them out into white houses, and then all of that movement has come back, and so the Natives are reclaiming their own health and their own health methods and their own language and all of that, and the government is supporting them because they really have no choice. They're at least supporting them to some extent.
I think that's really gaining momentum. I think they have a day of action actually coming up where the Indigenous peoples in Canada, that's coming up really soon, where they're doing blockades and other types of protests. So, and also the Native population in Canada is one of the fastest growing demographics, apparently. So, that's interesting that
was suppressed native approaches to health along with the whole culture. And I guess I can only assume that Canada followed the U.S. model or something like that in instituting sort of mainstream models to the exclusion of other possibilities.
Yeah, Canada definitely followed the American model in terms of medicine and, medicine reform, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And the John Hopkins model, as you call it, that's pretty interesting. I've never heard about that before. And question I have is, this was funded by, you said, the Rockefellers and...
Carnegie was a big... Mm-hmm.
Carnegie, right.
And
so,
J.P. Morgan. Mm-hmm.
So influential people with
bankers.
Money. Bankers. Okay, right. But then that became public health policy?
Yeah. It became medicine. Yeah.
And when was that? Like
1916, something like that. The Flexner Report. Oh. Just let me look at the date on the Flexner Report, actually. So all that, all that's been written and documented now, and these kinds of timelines, especially given, so the Flexner Report was published in 1910.
Hmm.
So that was the report. That was the so-called scientific report, which was, and it was a book-length study on medical education in both Canada and the United States, and it was under the aegis of the Carnegie Foundation. So it was paid for mostly by Carnegie, and the report basically called on the American medical schools to enact higher admission and graduation standards and to adhere to strict protocols of mainstream science in their teaching and research. So it really was an exclusive, it was really derived to be absolutely exclusive to any kind of health care that was not deemed science. And at this time, there was very much a very strong interest in this idea of technology and what progress meant, and very empirical, very much in terms of measuring, and also funded by Carnegie. So, so.
What state was the pharmaceutical industry in at that point? Was it in its early stages of development?
That's a good question. I mean, I'm not totally aware of all of the what drugs had been developed by then, but certainly most of modern drugs have been developed since then. And like antibiotics were mostly used during the Second World War, right? When was penicillin invented? If you think of chemotherapy drugs and all that, like before the Flexner Report, I mean, there was still a lot of bloodletting going on. There was still a lot of heavy metals being used. There was still a lot of what was Queen Victoria's? There was opium. Like there was different kind of more natural kind of medicines. Quinine was being used. I mean, and still medicines are made, 50% of all medicines are still made from natural substances. They're still made from foods and plants, 50% of them. And so it's not like that. It's not that medicine is totally separate from nature. It's just that they say it is, and they formulate it to be like that. And so.
Because that reinforces the authority of the institution, I suppose, if they. Mystify it to a certain extent in this way, but it's a kind of a level of expertise that the general public can't understand, so then that you have to
the hierarchy
follow the advice.
The hierarchy within medicine is also no accident. So yeah, I just looked up, this penicillin was discovered in 1928.
Okay, right.
So the hierarchy within medicine, I mean, even everything down to the lab coat, like everything down to like a patient stripping on their first visit and wearing a white, a white pinny, and the doctor standing there in a suit and a lab coat with equipment. I mean, those things, that's no accident. Those are derived to establish a hierarchy, like who is the boss and who is the plebe.
Oh, right.
So in medicine, there's also a big push towards, you know, doctors being called by their first name, or, you know, there's a whole lot of more humanist tactics being used now. And not only are patients ready for it, but I think practitioners are ready for it too. Maybe not all, but the new wave of healthcare is, I think, a lot more soft and human focused.
Mm-hmm.
And then we're just having so many problems with medicines. I mean, medicines just don't really cure things. Like, despite, you know, diabetes drugs getting better, chemotherapy drugs getting better, Alzheimer's disease coming onto the market, there's no less obese, there's no less diabetes, there's more. There's no less cancer, there's more. You know, so they're not working. The system is not working. And it's so expensive, the healthcare system can't afford it. Because if we look at the resources, so many resources are given to end-of-life care. If a third of healthcare resources are spent in the last, you know, six months to a year of a person's life, that's not even a reasonable model of healthcare. And so, the system can't justify itself in allocating resources like that.
Mm. Yeah, it's always interesting to me when public health makes these determinations that progressive measures are more cost-effective than just sticking with whatever the status quo would be. Because I think the whole push to marginalize smoking as culturally acceptable comes from exactly that kind of calculation. And Because in other ways, it's sort of against the kind of free market ideology to actually have the government intervention to that degree. But in that case, yeah, public health concerns like override.
I mean, with something like smoking, Rosemary, it's like the government's been around the whole time. You know, even the medical system was endorsing smoking in the 50s when they knew it was causing cancer, when they knew it was addictive, and they hid all of that research from the public for about 50 years. So this is a slow bleed. This is the business of medicine, is to only let out information as is beneficial to the status quo. Because something like smoking is like you get everybody addicted, which generates a lot of money, and then you spend a whole lot of money raising money and making money to get people to quit. At the same time, it's the tobacco companies that are making all the bad food. You know, I mean, Nabisco is owned by tobacco companies. Kraft is owned by tobacco companies. They're owned by Imperial Tobacco. And so bad food quality has always been in bed with the tobacco industry, and the tobacco industry has always been in bed with the medical community. And so this is not a conspiracy. I mean, this is stuff that you can just look up on, you know, this is stuff you can just look up and find the timeline of it now, because enough time has passed and it's all published and everybody can make sense of it now. When things are going on, you know, there's not enough mainstream information released and people can't tell what anything means. And so it's only after time passed, but then it's too late. Everybody's already got lung cancer.
But why did the government suppress studies about the dangers of smoking? What would be the advantage in doing that?
Financial.
Mm-hmm.
The tobacco companies are very wealthy.
Right.
Because tobacco companies are very wealthy. They give subsidies. They become stakeholders. I mean, now it's not necessarily it's not tobacco. Now it's Monsanto, one of the biggest stakeholders for the American government. You know, they basically provide provide the cash flow. I mean, politics is politics. Politics is business. Money. The American government, like, I'm no expert. I'm no political expert. And so in some ways I'm just talking from an impassioned observer. And, you know, I think I have a punk approach to my opinions about politics in the world. But I can't break it all down for you, but, you know, I know that it can be broken down.
Well, you know, it always interests me that there's the ideology that we've been living under for 30 or so years about neoliberalism and the free market and the government, get government out of business and get government out of public life, but at the same time,
this huge subsidies go to businesses. This corporate welfare is that's never changed. It's just it was just a public facing ideology for the government that justified other programs like reducing taxes on the rich. You know, and we see where that's led us to, like, vast wealth, you know, imbalance in the wealth. And 50% of the world's wealth is now, it's like, what is the percentage? Is it 1% or is it?
Yeah, I guess. I mean, that's what they say. It's 1%. That's the 99%. We're the 99%.
Yeah.
And who are those 1%? Those 1% are these big industrialists, these big venturists. I mean, now it's switching over maybe from products, it's switching over to services, or it's switching over to, you know, I don't know what Warren
the
Buffett
internet,
is investing
in
that. Yeah, internet, and, you know, whatever the billionaires are investing in. I mean, that's basically what's fueling the world, I guess. Rosemary, we're going to go to a break, okay?
This
is fun. But we're going to go to a break. And so join me back on Eating for Meaning with Rosemary Heather. She's the special guest host today, and I am the guest. This is Eating for Meaning on Blog Talk Radio.
Are you single and ready for an extraordinary relationship? This is Jill Crosby, owner of SpiritualSingles.com, the largest exclusively conscious dating site online. We provide conscious, spiritually evolved singles an easy, fun, effective venue to meet other like-hearted spiritual singles. Join for free today and meet your soulmate, twin flame, poly partners, and or friends on SpiritualSingles.com. That's SpiritualSingles.com.
She wants to know where the relationship is going. He didn't know it was going anywhere. Having an awareness of our differences can make or break a relationship. As men and women, we have no problem falling in love. The problem is staying in love. Janice Hoffman gives men and women easy-to-use tools to keep the passion alive in their relationship. The former training director for Mars Venus Institute, Janice Hoffman trained over 550 Mars Venus facilitators and counselors and developed curriculum for the Mars Venus workshops. Today, she is the award-winning author of Relationship Rules, 12 Strategies for Creating a Love That Lasts. Don't do more in your relationship. Do what you already do differently. Let Janice Hoffman teach you the skills to keep the passion alive. Get the passion back with Relationship Rules. Visit JaniceHoffman.com today and get your own autographed copy of Relationship Rules.
All right, and welcome back. This is Dr. Millie, and this is Eating for Meaning on Blog Talk Radio. And if you are liking what you hear, then I welcome you to follow us. This show broadcasts live every Thursday at 12 Eastern Standard Time and also is available over podcast after the show is through. Today, I have a very special guest host. In fact, her name is Rosemary Heather, and she is a curator and a writer, and she is the founder of a new digital startup online magazine based out of Toronto, but over the interweb, and she's interviewing me today on all of our mutual interests. How are we doing so far,
really?
Rosemary?
Good. Yeah, like you say, it's very fun to talk to you in this context, and maybe you could talk a little bit more about where you see naturopathic medicine going in terms of its increasing acceptance by, you know, broader sectors of society or integration with what has been mainstream medicine for the last, you know, 100 years about?
Well, healthcare is basically regulated by the provinces and the state. And so the regulation of any one health profession really just depends on lobby efforts and political party and wing or whatever invested interest is happening in any particular state at any particular time that a bill gets brought on to regulate the profession. And so Naturopathic medicine is regulated in about half of the Canadian provinces, and it's regulated in about going on 20 U.S. states, and with varying scopes of practice, So on the West Coast, California, Oregon, Washington, British Columbia, and Canada, naturopathic medicine, has an extremely full scope of practice, we would call it. Naturopathic doctors can do minor surgery. They can prescribe the top tier of drugs, including antibiotics and blood pressure medication. And so they're, I would just say, they're very much integrated. It's covered by insurance in these areas. And really, Obamacare did put forth a clause that insurance companies cannot prioritize medical doctors over alternative doctors in any licensed states. And so it is built into Obamacare that preventative medicine be deprioritized, and also that any licensed health service be exonerated from insurance benefits. And so, whereas in unlicensed states like New York, it's very much outside the healthcare system. So I practice very much in a gray. I do consultations. I don't do patient appointments. You know, there's all this technical language. I'm not technically allowed to touch the patient, do physical exams. And therefore, the awareness of naturopathic medicine in a state like New York is really low. Medical doctors are not aware. Medical doctors do not integrate. Whereas in licensed states, medical doctors integrate. There's also the opportunity in unlicensed states for these functional doctors, medical doctors, who are kind of practicing as naturopathic doctors, just to be more visible. And being a medical doctor, you just have more, business training, or you just have a different personality, and medicine is more visible anyway. And so I think that in some ways, functional medicine or osteopathy in licensed states or will become more visible and remain more visible than naturopathic medicine. So I think naturopathic medicine is actually always kind of at risk for being on the fringe. I don't think that and except for in these kind of certain specific provinces and states on the West Coast, I don't necessarily see it being fully integrated, although I don't know if naturopathic doctors really care about that. In terms of patients, it'd be nice if there was more communication for the patients. It just makes everything a lot more easy when there's, interrelation between the two health professions, when there's chart sharing, when there's a team approach, when there's integration, so the patient doesn't have to go from one place to another and bring all their paperwork every time, and when there's actually some cohesion between healthcare providers, it's a lot easier for the patient. So in that way, I think it's unfortunate that, as far as integration, I mean, it's just so spotty.
Is there a national body for naturopaths that is lobbying for legalization in the states, or maybe that's not, is that the right word?
There's the American Association of Naturopathic Physicians, and then there's the Canadian Association of Naturopathic Doctors, but because licensure happens at a state basis. You know, actually, Congress accepts naturopathic medicine. So it's not really, and naturopathic medicine has a good license in D.C. So it's really not necessarily the federal government. At this stage, the federal government is, you know, fairly supportive of naturopathic medicine. And, Congress has stipulated that naturopathic medicine is important for the healthcare of Americans. And, but it just really boils down to what the state says on licensure. And so, I don't know, some states are, I would say, fascist when it comes to medicine. And medicine, the medical association has very strong holds in states like Massachusetts and New Jersey and New York.
Yeah, I mean, that's the lobbying
groups, isn't it, for those?
I mean, they lobby against naturopathic medicine being regulated.
Yeah. But that's very interesting that Obamacare includes a receptivity or makes provision for naturopathic medicine, but it's at a federal level. So it just depends on the state, how that's actually implemented, you're saying.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, even nutritionists, you know, are regulated by different states, and so, you know, most state dietitians are deemed the appropriate have the appropriate training to be covered by insurance for providing nutritional information. And really, most other trained nutritionists feel that dietitians have the least of the educations and the poorest quality. So, you know, there's also that argument going on. So it really is not even just within naturopathic medicine, but within other health professions that relate to prevention, how to do it, how to go about doing it. So much, again, medical lobby. I mean, dietitians, of course, are the nutrition consultants to traditional medical doctors who don't actually believe in nutrition. So what you get is non-effective nutrition. You know, I mean, that's really basically the way I look at it. So,
but the thing is, the trend is moving in the direction of better nutrition because, from what I understand, McDonald's is sort of struggling to keep its market share, and places like Panera, this new sort of category of mid-range. It's not exactly fine dining, but it's not fast food. Restaurants are gaining in popularity where they do use better ingredients, and it's not just total garbage like Taco Bell or McDonald's. I mean, it does seem with the younger population there is more awareness about eating properly.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, definitely. No, I mean, the food, health food movement, organic food, non-GMO food, Food Babe. I mean, Food Babe is basically a company. It's just one woman she has a team now, but basically she's somebody who was a very good entrepreneur who basically was sick because of just working in a corporate environment and eating corporate food. And then once she became aware of the benefits of switching over to holistic nutrition, she started lobbying Washington, and she started lobbying all the big companies, Monsanto and Kraft and food companies, to first of all reveal ingredients that they don't reveal, and then start revealing chemical toxicities to them. So she's somebody who's really actually changed company decisions. Like, she actually lobbied for Kraft to remove FC dye, the yellow dye, from their Kraft dinner and put in annatto, which is a natural coloring. So she's really causing, like, beer companies are removing their caramel coloring. Like, she is really a force to be reckoned with, causing food changes at the corporate company level, because what's happening is she's making exposés on all these harmful chemicals that are included in food. And basically, companies are seeing their quarter profits drop. And so she's actually causing a huge wave in terms of you know, loss to McDonald's, and so all that pressure. It's basically just like, if people stop buying McDonald's, they're buying somewhere else because they want to be healthier, then that's the only thing that will make those companies change. But then, of course, those companies are, you know, the changes they make, they're also just still continuing to deceive the public about the health, you know, how healthy McDonald's Filet-O-Fish is or whatever, and they still do mass marketing campaigns. And I think that the public is starting to understand the difference between health marketing and actual health. And it's very, very, very complicated. It's very complicated to get the level of deceit that goes on with the food industry, everything from the manufacturing, everything from the agriculture and the fertilizers and the farming practices and seed use and you know, chemicals used, hormones, antibiotics, and pesticides, everything from that to the storage and the processing of foods and how they remove nutrients. I mean, the public has just been absolutely blind or has turned a blind eye to that for so long, and now it's just kind of like this timing. It's like, oh, there's a reaction to that now. People are realizing that, I mean, what they're eating is directly having an impact on their health, so they're making those changes to some extent.
Who is this person, a blogger, you said, who's been doing these lobbying exposés?
Yeah, it's foodbabe.com. Her name is Vanny Harry. I'm actually going to see her in New York next week. I'm pretty excited. She's just like, she's basically just, I don't know if she's in her 30s yet. She's young, she's hot, she's really smart, and she's just basically really aggressive and got a good thing.
What's it called?
Really,
food what?
Food Babe, B-A-B-E.
Oh, okay, got it. It's very interesting that this kind of thing can really just be down to a personality who has the savvy to really make changes. It's always fascinating to me that.
Yeah, and it's not the most. You know, she's a layperson. She's not a nutritionist. She's just somebody who like understands business. And that's the type of person it takes. It takes actually somebody who's corporate and corporate mindset to go head-to-head with other corporate mindsets. Somebody like myself, you know, like, yeah, I'm interested in entrepreneurial, but, I mean, I'm obviously a lefty, you know, who's just kind of trying to understand and grow and get a place in this business. I'm somebody who has tons of knowledge, you know, who has a deep understanding of my field, but have to work on the business and the you know, the marketing part of it. Whereas somebody like Vanny Harry, Food Babe, she comes from the total other side. Like, she's actually going head to head with people who have the same mindset as her.
Mm-hmm.
And it's effective. Mm-hmm. It's very effective. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Because it can be effective if it captures the imagination. So. In you know, one way or another, or yeah, people are good explainers. You're a good explainer, I think. Yeah, that's something that interests me as well, just how things become intelligible, how you make them intelligible, and also how things get picked up and become trends or a kind of awareness. That's kind of a mystery,
right? Everybody's seeking that golden phrase, golden title. Everybody's trying to find that really goes viral. That whatever that phrase is that triggers people's imagination or stimulates them to act or click or, you know, interact, engage. They're called engagements on Twitter or whatever. Everybody's looking for that.
Yep. There's no magic formula.
There might be, but I don't know what it is. Somebody might know what it is.
But, yeah, I guess it's an ongoing kind of science. Although, you know, it's my understanding that a lot of viral things are corporate. Things that appear to be amateur or, you know, just in the vernacular are actually corporate campaigns.
Yes.
Because that's a big project, is trying to figure out, exactly as you say, how to harness that phenomenon on the internet of things going viral. It's not as if... corporations didn't notice this and see the value in it if you can figure out how to manufacture it.
If you have resources, you can pay so many interns, or even just, you can just hire interns to have them work for you for free, to get information out there all across discussion boards and all over Facebook and all over Twitter and repeat exposure. They say it takes 10 times for somebody to see something, and then that works. So there's definitely a breakdown of information, like how people are, you know, how many times, for how long. But all over Facebook, you see sponsored ads. People are paying to have their ads posted, and, you know, companies are definitely doing that. and making it look like it's not companies as well. There's, and I mean, there's marketing, and then there's anti-marketing too, like sabotaging. So people are definitely also paying people to sabotage other people's products online, and it can be hard to find out who's doing what because they're just paying individuals.
You mean like bad reviews on Yelp and
Amazon
and
Or like tirades against, you know, and bringing in research to disprove somebody else's cause, the authority figures.
Yeah. So, I mean, also, it's funny because if you ever read any items about Russian politics on the Guardian website, then all the comments are obviously people paid to disparage anything that's said in the West about Russia, but it's very transparent, so it doesn't
war style tactics just for like money for business making. I mean, that is generally, that is essentially where we are.
Yeah.
I mean, not only are companies doing it, the government's doing it too. There's no separation between the government and the corporation now. You know, like this whole flights going down and the way Obama responds. What was that whole Korean story where the Sony employee, it was a Sony employee that was a whistleblower for company employees, and then the FBI said that it was coming from North Korea, and then that was caused because North Korea was mad because that movie was going to be released and all this. And that was all just lies. That wasn't true at all. It just all came from a Sony, a disgruntled ex-Sony employee. And it's like you cannot believe what the FBI reports. They're just totally lying. And then, and then the president is lying on their behalf just so that they can enter war, just so that they can buy. And that is, like, that whole tactic, I mean, Churchill did that, and it's like the Americans did that to enter into Pearl Harbor, but like now it's just used, it's, it seems like it's done on a daily basis. Like Bush did it to enter, you know, what do they call them, the weapons of mass destruction or whatever, right? Like Bush did it a few too many times, but like now it's even worse. Like it's so ingrained, it's just like daily behavior on part of the American government.
Well, it's kind of 1984. It's George Orwell. You know, it's more truth than fiction.
It's scary, but I think people feel that because they can't believe anything.
Mm.
So they have to do it themselves.
Yeah. That might be the growing awareness or the growing sort of 21st century consciousness is a bit more self-reliant. Probably because of the internet and the way that you can have more control, so you can sort of try and you know, do background research or look for the counter argument. So it creates a more, it's a very complex reality for everyone, but it might lead towards more autonomy, and I don't know, because it's not mass culture anymore. You know, it's something else.
There's, I think that there's more complacent people also because those kind of behaviors are so insidious and harder to understand and interpret. And it's so much stress to try to figure that out because it involves people's fundamental core belief systems about their, you know, their safety, their personal security, the security of their country, like their nationalism, like their political sidedness, like, you know, their patriotism, like especially here in the United States. Like I think that the complacency almost is born out of, for many people, it's like they have the opposite reaction because it's just, you can't look at it in an honest way because you'll go crazy or shoot yourself. But Canadians, a Canadian in the United States, is like I'm having a party down here.
Although Canada's got its own problems because now...
Canada and the United States have flipped. Yeah,
Stephen Harper and...
Yeah, the new George... The reign of George Bush III.
Yeah, he's had that, just the video. He's spending tax dollars on those 24/7. Have you seen those videos that he releases now? It's called 24/7, and one is about ISIS being a threat to Canada, so that Canada has to militarize further. And ISIS is not really a threat to Canada.
Isn't there a book now? It's called like The Party of One, and it's like the biography of Stephen Harper. It's called The Party of One, and so Stephen Harper doesn't even need the FBI or somebody like the CIA to back him, like Obama needs the FBI. Stephen Harper just goes on and just does his own propaganda himself.
Yeah.
Rosemary, we've got 5 more minutes. So if I don't know if there's anything that you want to say about Q&A, if you want to talk about your project, if you want to say anything, or just anyway, this is the time for us to be kind of wrapping up. This has been a great conversation. So much fun with
you. Yeah, absolutely. It's really great to talk with you, Millie, and thanks for inviting me on the show. And Q&A, I hope to interview you for Q&A at some point. It's just getting that project off the ground, and all I will say about it is that, my background is working as a writer, a journalist, with a focus in the visual arts. But because of the internet, basically, everybody in the many professions have had to sort of change their game, and it's definitely true of journalism, and it's a problem, but there's also opportunities. So Q&A is trying to take advantage of the unique opportunities that the internet offers to cater to niche interests, because people find what they're interested in through search, through keywords. The internet enables you to post things that are available 24/7 all over the world. The basic principle of my project is that you pay to download the interview because, journalists have to eat. So,
right.
I think the culture of the free internet it should be modulating in any case so that people just accept the principle of paying for the music that they want. Just because you can get it for free doesn't mean you should. And I think there shouldn't be a problem with paying for things like interviews, which is what I'm proposing to do, but they're going to be in-depth. And I have enough experience now working as a writer and an editor to, I think, produce really kind of solid content that people will be interested in over the long term. I want to promote that through the other unique capacities of the internet, which is it's social, it's through people sharing, it's this phenomenon of things going viral. And I think they all present really exciting opportunities, and I'm definitely interested in interviewing you because I can see that we have a lot to talk about. And, the only issue, I think, with putting things online for people to find is you have to be very, very clear about what it's about. That has to be upfront because people find things through keywords. You can't really be poetic about it. And I also think that the window for interest is very small, so you could lose people's interest very quickly unless you are clear about why they should be paying attention to what you've got on offer. So, so I want to develop an interview with you.
Yeah, I would love to. And so for people who are interested in learning more about Q&A or talking to you further, how can they get in touch with you?
Well, I mean, I have a website which is qqqandaaa.com, which is what I was able to buy in terms of a domain name, because Q&A is kind of a ubiquitous, everyday formulation, but that's part of the point of the project, is it covers all kinds of content. So there's the website, but it's really not much there at the moment. I'll also be selling these interviews through Amazon. But you can also reach me. I have a Twitter account, which is Rosem Heather. And I will have a Q&A Twitter also to get going. But yeah, you can contact me through Twitter or Rosemary Heather on Facebook. And I'm happy to hear from anyone who's interested in maybe possibly collaborating on a Q&A interview, or for any other reason.
Okay, great. So for collaborations, get in touch with Rosemary Heather. It's been a pleasure having you on today, and I hope you've all enjoyed this different type of episode here on Eating for Meaning. Thanks for tuning in. If you're interested in what you hear, follow along so you can listen in every week. Thanks again to my special guest host, Rosemary Heather. This is Dr. Millie Lytle for Eating for Meaning on Blog Talk Radio. Take my advice and feel better.